Toyota, the number one consumer choice on the most fuel-efficient automaker, and now during Toyota's number one for a reason event, get 0.9% APR financing on a 2010 Prius.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1993, a ship jammed with illegal Chinese immigrants ran aground off of Rockaway Beach in Queens, New York. In response, the FBI dug deep into New York Chinatown's human smuggling industry. They found a violent underworld steered by gangs and snakeheads, traffickers in highly profitable and illegal human cargo. Author Patrick Radden Keefe chronicles that world and the unlikely criminal mastermind at its heart, Sister Ping, in his new book, The Snakehead. This hour on Point, Patrick Radden Keefe on the heyday of human smuggling out of China and into America. You can join the conversation. What do you know of the snakehead's history? Would you see the business if it stared right at you in Chinatown? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is author Patrick Radden Keefe. He's written for The New Yorker, Slate, The New York Times, Wired, and more. His new book is The Snakehead, An Epic Tale of the Chinatown Underworld and the American Dream. Jane Mayer of The New Yorker calls it a Chinese-American version of The Sopranos, except that the mob boss is a grandmother who runs a human smuggling enterprise, and the story is true. Patrick Radden Keefe, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Take us back to that night, June 1993, and the whole idea of a kind of tramp freighter from halfway around the world foundering on the shores of Long Island, of Queens, is incredible. Paint the picture for us. What happened that night with the Golden Venture?
Well, a little bit before dawn, on a stormy night in June 1993, this ship suddenly appeared out of nowhere and ran aground off of Rockaway Beach in Queens. And people started jumping off of the ship. It was still about 150 yards out into the water, and the water was deep enough and rough enough that people were jumping off and trying to swim ashore, and some of them actually ended up drowning and dying.
Almost 2 in the morning, a pretty rough surf that night.
Absolutely. And the water was actually very cold, and so some of them, I mean, it turned out that these people had actually been in the hold of this ship for months and had become malnourished, and when they hit the water, a lot of them were actually in no condition to sort of survive this, and so 10 people ultimately died. And there ended up being a huge rescue operation with various people coming from all over New York and actually as far away as New Jersey to come and resolve this. One person who was there likened it to a plane crash on the high seas.
We all know the stories over the Rio Grande and the dangers in the deserts of the Southwest, but this, a boatload of illegal immigrants from China, for heaven's sake. I mean, that is a long, long trip indeed. It almost seemed like a ghost ship at the time. I remember, you know, the television coverage, and it just seemed it just came out of nowhere. Where had the Golden Venture and its, what, nearly 300 passengers come from? How did they arrive there at that spot that night?
Well, it was an amazing odyssey. I mean, part of what was remarkable about the voyage of the Golden Venture is, if you think about it, if you're leaving China and you want to take a ship to America, probably the best way to do it would be to just go east and try and hit California.
Huh, but nice ship, nice quarters, nice cabin.
There you go.
They stop off in Honolulu, and then you're on the docks in San Francisco.
And you're set.
Happy. Yeah.
And in fact, many ships had done that prior to the Golden Venture. But what they did was they sort of went the wrong way around the world. And so, in fact, the ship picked people up off of Thailand, took them down around Indonesia and Malaysia through the Straits of Malacca, down across the Indian Ocean
Incredible.
To Kenya, where they picked up a bunch of additional passengers who'd been stranded from a previous ship,
mm-hmm.
and that got them to about 290, down around the Cape of Good Hope, where it got hit by a huge storm and almost capsized, up through the North Atlantic, and then eventually landed in Queens. So it was a 17,000-mile journey.
Unbelievable. And months on board that ship.
It was 120 days, which, it's funny. I mean, it doesn't actually – that was a number that didn't mean anything to me until I started trying to find analogs in various famous voyages and how long they lasted. And I actually found out that the such as the Mayflower. The voyage that the Pilgrims took in 1620
yes.
to come to the New World took 60 days, and the Golden Venture took 120.
Here's double that and a much, much longer journey. Pull the lens back for us, if you would, then. I mean, it's just incredible that it happened at all, foundering on the shores of Queens, for heaven's sakes. But what was this part of? What was going on? What network was the Golden Venture a product of? What was happening that led that
these people to end up there in those circumstances?
It was really a sort of tip of the iceberg situation when the ship arrived, because when it did arrive, officials in the U.S. and people living in Rockaway suddenly woke up to this. But it turned out that actually 24 ships like the Golden Venture had come to the U.S. in the 18 months or so prior to the ship arriving. Those ones hadn't run aground, and people had actually made it into the U.S. illegally, and nobody had been apprehended. It turned out that there was actually this huge trade that had really started in the early 1980s with people leaving China to come illegally to the U.S. and these smugglers, these snakeheads as they're known, brokering these journeys. And part of what was surprising about this trade is that, in fact, the people weren't coming from all over China. They were coming from a tiny little area in Fujian province, which is a province in southeast China. It's right across the strait from Taiwan. And in fact, the overwhelming majority of people who come from China to the U.S. in the last three decades actually come from this one small area.
Because?
Well, that's a mystery. I mean, the one answer is that historically, Fujian province was actually a source of people leaving. People have always left there. It sometimes seemed in Fujian province that what they did best was leave.
So there was tradition, whether it was to the Philippines or Indonesia.
Exactly. And if you look at the Asian, the Chinese communities around the Pacific Rim in Southeast Asia, a lot of them are very intensely Fujianese. It's people who left in previous centuries. And in fact, in Taiwan, what we call Taiwanese is very similar to the dialect spoken in southern Fujian, because so many people left centuries ago to go to Taiwan.
It's important to cast our minds back. If we're talking about the 80s and early 90s, this is well before the economic boom, the miracle in China. This is when China was out of Mao Zedong's time, but still lots of poverty, lots of economic distress, lots of incentive to get out of there.
Exactly. I mean, there were a lot of things pushing people out. Having said that, though, one of the things that was very confusing to me when I started looking into this is that Fujian province had actually always done, you know, relative to the rest of China, fairly well. And at the time when people were leaving in really huge, epic numbers, I mean, nobody knows exactly what the numbers are, but just to give you an indication or a sort of back-of-the-envelope guess, in the mid-90s, the CIA put it at roughly 100,000 a year coming illegally from
out
China
of Fujian
to the U.S.
Yes. Into the U.S.?
Yes.
Well, out of that single province.
And yes. And so this is, I mean, of course, that could be right. It could be wrong. There's always a game of extrapolation
Sure,
here. But nevertheless, we're talking about a lot of people. And at that time, the economy in Fujian province was growing by about 10% a year. So it turns out that it's not absolute poverty that drives people to leave. And if you look at Sichuan or various provinces in the interior in China that have always been harder off, they've never been a huge source of out-migration. What it is when people start doing better, and some are doing better than others, that's what drives people to leave. So actually, when economic reforms came in the 80s, and you would see that suddenly your neighbor, who'd always been in the same circumstances as you were, suddenly your neighbor had air conditioning or a refrigerator.
And you didn't,
or a car,
and you couldn't
and you
see how to get it tomorrow. Go to America tomorrow.
Exactly.
But this didn't just happen by people padding across the border. This was ended up being a highly organized human flow. And it was run by what is called there, and you rightly name here, the so-called snakeheads. What are snakeheads?
Well, snakeheads emerged originally as people who would actually be able to get you out of mainland China and into Hong Kong, which at the time was a British colony and was a huge destination for people trying to leave China. You have to remember that there's an interesting relationship between China and the U.S. in terms of people getting out, where because of Chinese exclusion, which we had, our policy right through the Second World War was that Chinese could not come to the U.S.
This is the old anti-Chinese immigration policy that dating way back to the 19th
to the end of the 19th century. So for the first half of the 20th century, the U.S. basically said, we won't allow Chinese to legally come here. And then during the Second World War, that changed and we repealed exclusion. But then Mao took over and he said, I won't allow Chinese to leave. So for most of the 20th century, you couldn't legally leave China and come to the U.S. And these snakeheads sprung up to actually arrange these very complicated circuitous routes which would bring people from China to the U.S. and I should say also to other countries, to Australia, to Japan, to Europe.
And it wasn't just out of the goodness of their hearts, though there may be elements of that, you write about that, but this was huge business.
Well, there was huge demand for it. So Sister Ping, who is the central character in this book, she started out doing it, I would argue, out of the goodness of her own heart. She still argues today that it was always out of the goodness of her own heart.
This is Sister Ping, who was the major figure in New York's Chinatown, the kind of kingpin of the snakehead world in the United States, who you profile here. What were they paying her, though, if it was goodness of her heart?
Well, initially, she was bringing just friends and relatives, but then she got very good at it, and word spread that this is somebody who could actually bring you from China to the U.S., and she started charging around $18,000, and this is in the 1980s. And in fact, there were so many people brought over this way that the Cantonese community in Chinatown, the traditional mm-hmm. Chinatown community, mm-hmm. which saw these new Fujianese as sort of arvis,
interlopers,
come from the
yep.
countryside, mm-hmm. they actually derisively referred to them as $18,000 men, because the suggestion was that that was what they'd paid to be here.
It didn't stay at $18,000.
It did not. And so by the 1990s, particularly after Tiananmen Square, the demand to come was so great that the price jumped to $35,000.
$35,000 for a journey that could take you anywhere in the world before you arrived in New York City.
And could take months or years. And you could also die. I mean, a ship could overturn, and they did.
People made millions.
They did. I mean, the estimate of the FBI, and again, you've got to be careful with these statistics, mm-hmm. but the sort of guesstimate of the FBI is that Sister Ping made about $40 million doing this. And as a friend of mine said when I mentioned this, that's all tax-free, so that's $80 million.
That's a lot of money. And a lot of those people paying that paid it by working all around the United States and certainly in New York for a long, long time, almost in indentured servitude.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. They didn't – what would happen is obviously people didn't have $18,000 or $35,000 mm-hmm. to pay Sister Ping before they left. So what they would do is pay a small down payment. And then if they survived the journey – and that was an if
yep. –
and they managed to get here, they would have a brief window, about 72 hours, to pay off the balance. And they had to borrow that from all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And then they would be essentially indentured to the people they borrowed from.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a wild chapter in illegal immigration and the heyday of humans smuggled into New York's Chinatown. My guest is Patrick Radden Keefe. His new book is The Snakehead. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Describe the system for us. How did it work exactly? How did these people in far-off Fujian province in China get into the network? How did they get in touch with this little old lady running her little shops in New York's Chinatown, put the money down, you know, on the other side? We'll come back to the journey, but on the other side of it, they arrived and you said they had 72 hours to pay up, or then what? How did this kind of indentured servitude work?
Well, I mean, the first step, if you wanted to leave China at that time, was to find a snakehead. And Sister Ping was actually one of the first. She was really a pioneer of this route in the early 80s.
She had come herself from
China. She had come herself, but legally. This mm-hmm. is one irony here, is that she actually came on a visa in 81. But by 84, and possibly earlier than that, she was already moving people in. And what would happen at that time is generally you would go by plane. And so you would go to her, you would make a down payment to somebody who knew her in China, mm-hmm. and then you would get a letter. And it was a letter of invitation to Guatemala. And it would say, come and visit your family in Guatemala. Now, the fact that you didn't have family in Guatemala was irrelevant here. You could take that letter and go and get a passport. And then you would actually go to Hong Kong and you would have a reason to leave. You could mm-hmm. get an exit visa and you would go and fly to Guatemala. In Guatemala, Sister Ping would actually meet you there and she would coordinate with other snakeheads in Guatemala and bring you up overland through Guatemala, through Mexico, up into the United States.
So they were actually part of the coyote world in that way.
Indeed, and still are. I mean, I should mm-hmm. say for all these years, that's actually been one of the routes that people have taken. But people would also at that time fly into Toronto and then come south over the Niagara River, which was another way that it worked. And what happened is that demand basically grew so great that they couldn't really send people by plane anymore in the numbers that people wanted to go. And so by the 1990s, what happened is they started actually sending people in ships. And at that point, I mean, it was almost as if this was a cargo business like any other. And
though
the
for a time, it did stay airborne via Bangkok. Bangkok, Thailand was a big point. Why?
Well, Bangkok was the big hub. Mm-hmm. One thing I found in this research is that if you want to run a really effective international smuggling business, what mm-hmm. you need to do is find hubs that you can use, sort of logistical hubs where there's enough corruption that you can really go into business, but there's also enough infrastructure that you can send things through there. Guatemala was one of these. Bangkok was another. So during the 80s and early 90s in Bangkok, if you went in with phony documents to the airport, the corrupt officials at the airport would turn a blind eye.
They were kind of in on it because this is money laundering in a way, traveler laundering. They would turn you into a legitimate traveler.
Exactly. There's a great story I heard from some officials when I went to Thailand to do research. He said that you would walk into the departures lounge in Bangkok International Airport at mm-hmm. that time, and there'd be 9 ticket windows, and there'd be small lines of 1 or 2 people at each of the first 8 windows. Mm. And then at the 9th window, there'd be a massive line of Fujianese waiting to get in because that was the one who was
boxes
on the take.
Boxes and bags.
Yeah.
But eventually that got cleaned up, and the whole trade went to the sea.
Exactly. And so there's one of the main characters in the book, really one of the heroes, is a young guy named Sean Chen, who had an extraordinary journey. He left Fujian province as a teenager without any ID, with very little money. He basically had a change of clothes. And his route was fairly typical. He made his way to the border with Burma. He made his way to Kunming, then crossed mm-hmm. into Burma. Mm-hmm. And then local snakeheads, took him on a trek through the mountains of Burma, which was a really arduous journey.
Oh, yeah, that's Golden Triangle and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, first of all, this was the center for opiate production mm-hmm. at the time. Mm-hmm. Then you also had people dying in the mountains mm-hmm. because of dehydration, or they lost their way. Yeah. He got to Thailand and was in a safe house waiting to fly out, but they couldn't get him a passport and couldn't get him on a plane because there had been a crackdown at the airport. And it was at that point that someone said to Sean Chen, well, look, we could get you in a ship right now.
He took it. What was his journey like?
Well, he didn't even go on the Golden Venture. He went on an earlier ship that Sister Ping had been involved in called the Naj 2. And he had heard, look, it'll take you maybe a few weeks or a month to get to the U.S. But what happened is that ship ended up breaking down and limping into the port in Mombasa, Kenya. And so Sean and these hundreds of other Chinese passengers who were with him suddenly found themselves stranded in Africa. And he ended up stranded there for 6 months.
It could take a long time to make this journey to the States. Once these snakehead smuggled Chinese got into New York, some could pay off, though I don't know, that's tough to do in 72. How do you arrange that to borrow 18 or 35 grand in 72 hours? And if you don't, then what happened?
Well, what you would do is call everyone you knew, and your family would call everyone they knew, and you'd borrow very small amounts of money. And here is where an interesting characteristic of the Fujianese community comes into play, which is a very tight-knit community in which credit lines are actually sort of informal credit lines are actually fairly easy to obtain. And so generally paying off the debt wasn't a problem. And that was a good thing because if it was a problem, there was always the threat of violence. And in fact, it's amazing to think back now. If you walk through New York's Chinatown right now, it's hard to picture this, but during the 1980s and 1990s, there were these criminal gangs that really ran riot in Chinatown. It was an incredibly high homicide rate, and they were in charge of enforcement. So Sister Ping brought these gangs in, and what they did was when you got here, if you were a passenger, they were the ones who held you at gunpoint until you paid.
Wow. We're going to learn more, but let's get a call or two in here first. Columbia, South Carolina. Peter, you're on the air.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was a federal agent up in New York City about maybe 10 years ago, and I had worked. I didn't work for Immigration and Naturalization, but had worked on a task force one time. We picked up, helped out on an interagency task force. We picked up probably maybe 75 or 100 Fujianese. These would be the people who would have paid for the journey.
Yeah.
And I felt bad for them at the time, and I remember one of the guys explained to me, said the whole smuggling operation was 105-pound Chinaman beating up on 95-pound Chinaman to bring him over. I remember feeling bad for him at the time, but I don't know if you address this in your writing. Has law enforcement taken more of an aim at the people creating the problem rather than the poor folks who have this terrible journey over here and then, you know, on top of that, do end up getting caught and sent back or whatever ultimately happens?
Peter, we'll dig into that, but describe for us what made you feel sorry. I mean, where would you find these illegal immigrants? In what kind of circumstances? And I guess you were well aware that you were sending them all the way back to go after they'd paid and worked.
And the circumstances they were in weren't much worse than some other ghetto-type circumstances that I've seen in New York and mm-hmm. buildings where I've served search warrants and things like that. But, what was rough and definitely realizing these people were really the frontier of immigrants in the United States at the time was when we finally got a Fujianese interpreter, I just remember asking questions, you know, getting sort of the pedigree questions that you normally do when you take somebody in. And these people didn't know the addresses. One gentleman didn't even know the name of the place that he worked at. I said, "Where's your boss's name? Do you know his nickname, his first name?" Didn't know any of that information. He said, "Oh, I could take you there on my bike. I could show you how to get there from my from my house." But otherwise, didn't even know the street that it was on. Because that very little English. I remember looking at the interpreter and one of the other agents with me. I said, "Well, who do you complain about when you go home at night?" Asking about the boss. My boss was in that circle of people.
Right.
He didn't quite get the joke, but
Peter, let us pick it up, and thank you so much for that call. Patrick We'll go to his question of how it moved on up the ladder from picking up the immigrants to picking up the Sister Pings, and it did happen, and she's in prison. But what about your own sympathies as you dug into this? You heard where his were, and he was law enforcement.
Yeah, I came down almost precisely where Peter was, where I tended to regard the snakeheads as complicated figures. One of the interesting ironies that I sort of wrestled with is that to this day, Sister Ping is actually revered as a hero in Chinatown, and that's something we can talk more about.
A latter-day Harriet Tubman, you describe some Chinese there thinking of her as.
Exactly. I mean, they describe her as Robin Hood very regularly, which is funny because the FBI then will respond to that, well, you know, Robin Hood never made $40 million. Mm-hmm. But I did develop enormous sympathy for the people who've come over, for the both the great lengths that they went to get here and make a life here, and then the terrific degree of exploitation that you notice all along the line, which isn't to say that they don't go into it with their eyes open. They know that there are going to be hazards. They know that there are going to be risks. They know that when they get here, they'll be living illegally. They'll be making very little money.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this guy, Sean Chen, and some of the other passengers aboard the Golden Venture, who had just an incredible story and an incredible odyssey getting here, I really did, I would share with Peter that sympathy for them.
What about that exploitation? Continue on how that worked. You described the streets of New York's Chinatown full of kind of bully boy thugs who would beat you up or kill you if you weren't paying, or if you weren't, what, working at the job that was paying? I mean, when we go to a Chinese restaurant in New York Chinatown in the 1990s, was the food being made by people who were kind of chained, or the dishes being washed by people sort of chained to the sink?
Well,
figuratively,
not literally.
I mean,
because again, they weren't trying to pay off the snakeheads at that point. They generally settled their debts.
Okay.
But look, having said that, those restaurants were all paying extortion money to the gangs.
For what? Did it have to do with immigration or just
no, that was
straight
just
up old time mafia?
These guys would roll in and collect from everyone. And if they didn't pay up the money, they were in trouble. And look, because you have, and this is true as much today as it was then, because a lot of the staff in those restaurants is illegal, it's exactly what Peter was saying. Who do you turn to when your boss is exploiting you? Say you get an injury on the job,
mm-hmm.
And you want some kind of compensation. Who do you go to? You don't go to the authorities. Say your boss, and this happened all the time,
mm-hmm.
withholds your check and says, I'm not going to pay you this week. I'll pay you next week. And then next week, I'm not going to pay you this week. I'll pay you next week. You have to keep coming to work because you don't want to leave and not get that money. But you mm-hmm. also have no guarantee that boss is going to pay the money.
Ever.
Who do you go to?
Mm-hmm. Sister Ping was at the top. Give us some of her exploits here. How did she work it? What kind of adventures did she get into?
Well, when she first arrived, almost immediately she started sending for people. And the funny thing with Sister Ping is that she actually developed a reputation as one of the best snakeheads. And part of the reason for this is she had these policies, which in the Fujianese community made her very popular, but to you and I might sound ludicrous. So,
for instance,
mm-hmm. if you were one of her customers and you were on a ship and the ship overturned, she would pay for your burial and often offer free passage to another relative, which to me, obviously, I mean, if you gave me that offer after one of my relatives had died the first time around, I'd say,
come on,
no thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a sort of satisfaction guarantee. If you got over and were busted by immigration on your way over and got sent back, mm-hmm. a lot of people made this journey again, which raises all kinds of interesting questions about the way we deal with immigration. But, I mean, we would deport all kinds of people who would be home for a week
mm-hmm.
and then turn around and come again. And she would often do that for free. The other thing she did that was really canny and I think shows you what an interesting entrepreneur she was is that her customers would get here and they would start, after they paid off their snakehead debt, they'd be saving money. They lived very frugally,
mm-hmm.
and they would try and save their U.S. currency and send it back to China. But they didn't want to send it through the Bank of China or through Western Union. I mean, these mm-hmm. people were illegal, and they wanted low rates. And so she set up an underground bank to remit money back. And so, interestingly, she was bringing people on the one hand, and then when they got here and started saving money, she was then helping them – she was sort of facilitating them sending the money back.
She was their banker.
She was absolutely their banker, and she did it in an interesting way. She had – the money never moved. What she did was she had a big pile of money basically in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and a big pile of money in China.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to send, say, $100 to China, you would go to her and say, I want to send it. You would give her the $100. She would then call somebody in China who would take that $100 from her collection there and bring it to your mother living in
mm-hmm.
some little remote village on
mm-hmm.
a motorbike.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, somebody in China was ultimately going to want to send $100 back here, maybe to satisfy a snakehead debt. And she would balance the books at the end of every month, and that was that.
Amazing. And many more stories here. Charleston, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, what do you know?
Well, I guess I have just a few comments. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I'd really encourage people that are interested in this topic or generally interested in human trafficking on any level to read your author's book, because it sounds like he really knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's done a lot of research. Myself, I'm just a college student, but I've devoted a lot of my free time to studying human trafficking globally, and I think this whole discussion has really made me think about that quite a bit, especially regarding sex trafficking and forced labor trafficking on the global level, not just dealing with Chinese, but I think your author would agree that you can find Chinese pretty much like a lot like Filipinos as far as sex workers and as forced laborers pretty much all over the globe, just everywhere.
But Tom, let me ask you, a lot of these people from Fujian clearly came of their own desire and volition. I've been wondering myself about this word trafficking and how it does or doesn't apply here. I mean, this is not the same as sort of women forced in, you know, across borders and into work in some horrible brothel somewhere. There's an element here of old time, let's go to America impulse. Isn't there? Patrick, what do you say? I mean, is this trafficking? It is in the sense that the smugglers are trafficking and smuggling, but it's not
This was one of the trickiest issues that I wrestled with in the writing, because you have human smuggling and human trafficking, and these two terms are often used interchangeably, but trafficking generally implies that there's some kind of false pretenses, that I tell you you're going to be a model or a waitress, and then when you get there, I take your passport away and you're a prostitute. And that happened less often in the Chinese context. I should say it happens all the time all over the world. It's a major problem. But when I went into Chinatown and also to China and asked about this and said, how often are people actually sort of duped and forced into forced labor, people said, oh, no, they knew going in what they were getting into. And generally, it was, frankly, to work in restaurants and garment factories, which could be exploitative, but people often knew what they were getting into.
Sister Ping was ultimately arrested. Is she still sitting in Danbury Prison in Connecticut?
She is, and I think she probably will be for the rest of her life.
I mean, maybe she's listening right now.
She could be.
Sister Ping, if you've got access to a phone, call. We'd love to hear from you. What were the charges? What ended up putting her in prison?
Well, this is the ship, the Golden Venture, which is probably the most famous of these smuggling ships, ended up launching a huge law enforcement investigation. And actually, to go back to the question earlier, in some ways, this is the story of a learning curve for law enforcement as they kind of got on the ball and pursued the snakeheads. And they went after all these different people over the years, but they couldn't catch Sister Ping. In 1994, after the Golden Venture came in, the FBI had an indictment for her. And on the eve of the indictment, she fled the country. It was the last time she used her own passport. And she went back to China and actually continued living there for 6 years and doing her business, running her business around the globe. When they did catch her, it was in Hong Kong in 2000. She passed through Hong Kong and was caught. And she was tried in this very colorful trial in 2005. And all the testimony in the trial, or a lot of it, was about the Golden Venture. It was all of her former associates talking about this ship. But ironically, this was the ship that brought her down. But she played a smaller role in this ship than she had in
others. She only
had
a couple of her clients out of those 300.
Only two of them. Though I should say one of them died, which seems significant. And she had helped finance the voyage. She sort of put up some of the money for it. But she was ultimately convicted of smuggling and sort of trafficking in ransom proceeds and a variety of other charges, and got 35 years in prison, which I think did show a development on the part of law enforcement where they've really now got, they're able to give snakeheads sentences that have real teeth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a wild chapter in illegal immigration and the heyday of humans smuggled into New York's Chinatown with Patrick Radden Keefe. He's author of the new book, The Snakehead, and it is quite a tale. Mountains of Chinese immigrants smuggled into the United States, first by air, then by sea. The Golden Venture went down right on the shore of Queens. Talk about taking the boat right to the destination. Let's get a call from Vance in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Vance, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you today? I was wondering if they caught the captain and the crew of the Golden Venture, and if so, what happened to them? And I will take your call offline, please.
Thank you, Vance. And for that matter, the passengers. I mean, it's a pretty rough story.
Well, so To go back to the story where we left it a little while ago, mm-hmm. the ship ran aground just before dawn on June 6, 1993, and it just so happened that there were two Park police officers driving by just doing a routine patrol of the area, Breezy Point in Queens, and they saw this ship.
A little mast light they first
they
saw.
They saw a mast light sort of flickering mm-hmm. In the night. And so you had this huge rescue operation with these people jumping off and Coast Guard boats and helicopters and the news media covering this whole thing within hours of
How
the arrival.
How far from the beach was the ship grounded?
Maybe 150 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And once they'd assembled everybody on the beach, they were giving people CPR and trying to attend to them. They were actually fairly quickly able to segregate out the captain and the crew, who were by and large Indonesian and Burmese, not Chinese. And then also some of the snakeheads on the ship who'd been the kind of onboard enforcers who had
And this was a
order.
Wild, rough scene. I mean, people were screaming, some were dying, some wandered off in the night, others were trying to bury themselves in the beach to hide, maybe.
It was chaotic. At the time, it was the biggest, it was one of the biggest rescue operations in New York history.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had all kinds of people. You had a huge line of ambulances and fire engines and so on. And they did ultimately arrest the captain and the crew, and they tried those people, and they had they got sort of sentences that didn't compare to Sister Ping's, but they caught them fairly early on at a time when the penalties for this were still fairly low. The passengers were another story. Now, up until that point, if you were Chinese and you had come to the U.S., particularly after Tiananmen, mm-hmm. we took a very generous view of asylum for people fleeing China.
The law was actually changed by George Bush Sr.
Indeed. So George Bush Sr., after Tiananmen, under pressure, interestingly, from congressional Republicans who felt strongly that the communist government in China was pretty repressive and also that the one-child policy in China was causing a lot of forced abortions and sterilizations, George H.W. Bush had an executive order which basically said, look, if you have people coming from China and they say that they believe in democracy and they're fleeing the one-child policy, we'll give them enhanced consideration mm-hmm. for their asylum applications. And this was part of the reason that you actually had so many people coming at that time, because they thought, look, if I can, you have to be in the U.S. to ask for asylum. Mm-hmm. So if I can just get there, they'll let me stay. Sean Chen, the guy who's one of the central characters in the book, he ended up coming up out of the hold of the ship. He'd been in the ship for months, seeing the lights of New York in the distance, jumping off the ship into this cold, cold water, and he could swim. Mm-hmm. And so he struggled to swim to shore, and he was in the water for, you know, maybe a half an hour or so, and he finally staggered in, and he passed out on shore.
Mm-hmm.
He had been told, as they all had, if you can just get to shore, you can stay there. You'll be all right. And he woke up some hours later in a hospital bed. And he was in a hospital, Johnny, and he looked around, and there was an African-American cop there who said, you're in New York City. And Sean felt this sort of enormous surge of relief.
Mm-hmm.
And then he looked down, and he noticed something. He was handcuffed to the bed. And actually, all of these passengers were immediately thrown into prison because they'd sort of come at the wrong time, and they'd really badly embarrassed the U.S. And it was at that point that we started reevaluating how easy we wanted to make it for Chinese to get asylum in the U.S.
There was a long road for many of them in prison and some in hospital and then prison. Let's go to Jie Ming in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jie Ming, you're on the air.
Hi. Hey, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I'm Chinese, and I came to the States through a graduate school, but I know of someone who used to live in New York City
uh-huh.
who went through the same journey as you have in the book. So I guess he didn't pay off all the money that he owned the snakehead.
Yes.
So he ended up moving out of New York City and got his American citizenship through a Taiwanese American who has American citizenship. And he works really hard, and he ended up owning a pretty big Chinese buffet business.
Wow.
So he was pretty wealthy. But later on, I guess the Chinese gangsters from New York City followed him all the way up to the state that he moved to and kidnapped the entire family.
Wow.
And that's just part of the story. And another part of the story is that actually he still has his wife and his daughters in Fujian province. And his wife here in the States knows everything. And every time he goes back to China, he would spend time with his ex-wife.
So he has two families, one family here and one there. Jia Ming, let me ask you, as as a Chinese in the United States, how do you look at these snakeheads? Someone like Sister Ping, do you see her as a Robin Hood figure, you know, helping people, or as an exploiter? How do you see her?
Well, sure, I don't see her as a Chinese Robin Hood. It's very complicated, and so many people, at least back in the 90s, tried so hard to escape China, and I don't know, I don't respect her, but she survived war, she exists with reasons, so I guess some people need her, and this is how she exists.
Just a fact of life. Jiaming, thank you very much for that story. Patrick, that's quite an incredible story in its own right. As somebody who first ran away from the debt, ultimately tracked down, Jiaming says, by gangsters who kidnapped his whole family.
Right. I mean, there's a lot to talk about there. Thank you for the call. A couple of things. I mean, one that's interesting about what you say is that this guy actually became quite successful. And that is not surprising to me. And this is where the American dream thing comes
in. This is Jiaming's friend who ran away from the gangsters.
And in fact, I mean, a lot of people who got over this way basically thought, look, I need to bend the law a little, break the law a little, but ultimately I'm going to get there and I'm going to be the best kind of entrepreneurial U.S. citizen you can imagine. I'm going to work my butt off and I'm going to do well. And a lot of them have. But having said that, it's tough to outrun the past. And if you don't pay that debt, the gangs could be incredibly brutal and have long memories and would track people down. And those kinds of kidnappings used to happen all the time and were very difficult for law enforcement to deal with, because a lot of the time what would also happen is, say they want you to pay up. They, you know, if they kidnap you here in the U.S., then somebody can go to the cops. But a lot of the time what would happen is the cops here in New York would get a call, and it would be from somebody living in New York. Mm-hmm. And they would say, they just called and they've kidnapped my family in China, and they want me to pay, not here, but to send the money through a service like Sister Ping's back to China. Now, if you're with the NYPD, what do you do with that?
What did they do? I would have no idea what to do there.
It was tough. I mean, they would try and cooperate with the Chinese authorities, but China has tended not to want to cooperate with the U.S. on law enforcement matters, which is part of the reason that Sister Ping, when she went back in 94, could live there and keep doing business in China for 6 years. The FBI knew where she was, but China wouldn't go after her.
And what about our caller, Jiaming? You hear his ambivalence about a snakehead like Sister Ping. I mean, you kind of hear him saying, well, she's no Robin Hood. On the other hand, these people had dreams. She helped facilitate them, she and others.
And this is and look, I mean, I heard this again and again, and I think particularly in the Fujianese community, you'll hear it even more so, and you'll hear it even today. There's a sense that people knew what they were getting into. There were a few kind of instances in which boats went down or people were hurt, but ultimately, listen, if that happens 1% of the time, then that's a small risk to take. And that's what I heard again and again and again from people who came over in this manner.
Let's go to Beth in Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi. I have two very quick stories, and I'll take comments off the air.
Okay.
One, it's the yin, black and white is the yin-yang symbol, the good and the bad and everything in between. My former mother-in-law was and still is what really is, you know, a Robin Hood. I call her Lady Robin Hood. She, from the late 60s through the mid-80s, brought in probably about 300 Chinese immigrants. She herself was from the Toisan province, near Canton province, survived the China-Japan War, lost brothers and sisters due to starvation, almost lost herself, came over here, married, fixed marriage, the whole bit.
Yep.
Now, she had a bean sprout shop, Mung Bean Sprouts, and she bought properties in Chinatown, then Brookline, Newton, New Hampshire, and Florida, just off of bean sprouts.
Wow.
And she provided one floor on this industrial building in Chinatown. And it was an apartment or a dormitory, basically, and they just all came, all men. She provided them with getting green cards, fixed them up with restaurants. And
did they first come, though, Beth, did they first come legally or illegally? Was she a snakehead, in effect?
No, she was not a snakehead, and she hated the local Chinese mafia, which was called the Tong, and she just did her thing. And there were actually many people in China, several people in Chinatown who did as she did. She's still to this day highly respected in the community. And she did get them green cards. If they came illegally, she made sure that they were legal, because she wasn't going to take the rap for anything. And if they didn't, or they caused any trouble, which was usually drinking and gambling, At that time, they were still smoking some opium in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
They were out. I mean, she was very, very strict. And approximately 300 men who to this day have also properties in Brookline and Newton, more, you know, most of them Brighton, very affluent, very successful down to a man. And the other story is a wonderful Kung Fu master who I studied under in the early 80s, who was, you know, it was a hit job by the Chinese mafia because he wouldn't do what they said he, you know, should do. He was also a Robin Hood in providing medical care in the Chinese system free for all these workers, people that couldn't afford it, people who could afford it. I studied under him and to practice to this day. And he was knocked off because he wouldn't do, you know, their bidding. They wanted him to treat their people who got shot, beat up, et cetera, in their crime, and he refused, and he was shot right in the head by one of their people, and that was that. So they're, you know, both the viciousness of the Tong, the Chinese mafia, and there were two conflicting gangs at the time. And one last comment is that I also... I sat in with that time Commissioner Bratton, who is now in L.A., with about 10 other young Chinese businessmen to get these people off the street. And we were very successful. We put posters up. And I was 8 months pregnant at the time, and Bratton looked at me, the only white girl in this group, white Jewish girl, and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" So that's my story.
Beth, those are great stories. It's really interesting. Patrick Radden, Keith, I mean, Beth tells you stories full of compassion and real knowing of these people. At the same time, she lifts another little corner of, I mean, the old movie thing, you know, Chinatown, like all this stuff is going on under the covers. You've been in this interesting conversation at Slate with Sudhir Venkatesh talking about whether this wave of immigrants was somehow fundamentally different in the exoticism of the way they arrived from, you know, other eras of American immigrants, Irish or German or Swedish or, you know, you name it. How do you end up looking at this? He's saying, you know, you may have a different population here that's not really interested in becoming part of America. They, you know, they came over in these wild ways. They live in the isolated enclaves. I've read you pushing back against that and saying, no, it may have been exotic, but this is the continuing story of American immigration.
Absolutely. I mean, I did push back in that dialogue with Sudhir, insofar as I think that what's different about this group is the extraordinary lengths that they have gone to get here, and the ingenious and sort of circuitous routes that St. Ed's like Sister Ping came up with to get them into the country. But once they arrive, I mean, I feel as though ultimately if you look back at the history of any other ethnic group that's arrived in large numbers in U.S. history, a lot of the time there will be some transgressions along the way as you try and get a toehold. But I think, you know, I see the children of a lot of these people who've come and they speak English, they're assimilating. A lot of them will end up going to college. They will sort of move into the American mainstream. Having said that, I think that there are some really interesting dynamics that we see in the Fujianese community specifically. And I wouldn't generalize and say Chinese, but I mean specifically the Fujianese community. Which are pretty unusual, and it's funny this story about I mean tragic obviously this story about the Kung Fu master, but there is an interesting role that this kind of violence and opportunism plays in Chinatown and played. There's an episode in the book where Sister Ping encounters this guy named Ake, who's another major figure in the book, and he was a really ruthless, brutal killer, a gangster who ran a street gang. And the first time they meet, Ake robs her family at gunpoint, points a gun at her children, and demands money. The second time they meet, he does it again because he didn't get enough money the first time. The third time they meet, Sister Ping actually summons him because she wants to go into business with him.
She hires him, basically.
Exactly. And strangely, she recognizes this brutality. She recognizes that he's offended her in this way. And I think this is something you would never see in the Italian mob. Mm-hmm. But she was a pragmatist and a businesswoman. And so when they first met, he basically said, "Look, I'm so sorry about what I did to you a few years back." Yes. And her response was, "That's what happened in the past. Now we're talking business."
What does this mean for, I don't know, the United States of America, or is it just about one little tiny corner of it?
Well, I think from a law enforcement point of view, in terms of the FBI and the government trying to tackle this, it makes it very difficult when you have these sort of fluid associations to go after the snakeheads. And that is what I think they're increasingly trying to do and have been trying to do, to penalize the snakeheads and not the passengers. But it's a struggle when you have someone as pragmatic as Sister Ping who will form these fluid alliances.
Is it over now that China's economy has boomed, has roared?
No. It's changed. People are still coming over. They're still paying snakeheads. The fee now, and prepare for some sticker shock, is $70,000 to come. And when I was over in China, what people told me is it's changed a little bit now. Back in the 80s and 90s, it was the brightest and best who left, who took the risks. They were too big for Fujian province. They wanted to come to the U.S. and make a name for themselves. Now that you can do really well in the Chinese economy, people are saying it's really only the people who can't make it in China who try and come.
But the Chinese economy has turned down again, like the U.S. economy recently.
And I think that raises an interesting possibility, which is that what was keeping people in China was these manufacturing jobs along the southeast coast around Fujian province and elsewhere. And now we're seeing a huge internal migration in China, people leaving the factories because of the economic crisis, going back inland. I think that if that continues, we will also see an uptick in the snakehead trade because they won't just be going back inland to their ancestral villages. They'll be looking elsewhere for places where they can do better than they are. China.
Patrick Radden-Keefe's new book is The Snakehead, an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream. You really open a window for us on a world that many do not know, and it is fascinating. Thank you so much for your research and for the book you bring us here, Patrick. Thanks
a lot for joining us. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed
it. Listeners, thank you for joining us. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Sara Abdurrahman, Molly Connors, and Abby Ruzica. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.